From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents, reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. On today's show, we check in on the Kansas State House, one of the most conservative in recent history.
Farmers in Kentucky are trying to make it legal to cultivate hemp.
No, I'm not some crazy person who's been brainwashed. I mean, I look at the realities of it, and I've looked at the potential of it. It's not a tobacco replacement, but it could be better than corn and soybeans for us.
And a debut album from a local cellist and a violin player.
So we were thinking of this song as kind of a cold, wintry Siberian song. Sometimes when it's really snowy here, the ice drifting by in the Missouri River.
There's like ice chunks.
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news.
I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region.
This week, both the Missouri and Kansas legislatures were near the midpoints of their 2013 sessions. And as Kansas lawmakers return from their mid-session break, KCUR's Steve Bell checked in with Lawrence Journal World State House reporter Scott Rothschild.
Scott, for years I have heard about the significance of what they call turnaround day, the mid-session point. Is there really any significance about what can or can't get passed after turnaround day?
Well, there's some significance, but there's some urban legend there, too. It does kind of, there are still lots of issues that can come up after turnaround.
Now, everybody's interested in the big issues. And when Governor Brownback gave his State of the State address, he mentioned tax reduction was a biggie. His school plan, he mentioned judicial selection. He mentioned this issue of we need a culture of life that implied something about abortion legislation. The legislature seems to have added a couple of other priorities, unions, particularly public employee unions, and gun control. Is that pretty much the list of the big issues that are being dealt with by the legislature at this time?
Yeah, those are pretty much it. Starting off with the tax proposal, the governor last year signed a decrease in the state income tax. To do that, he has to basically increase taxes. The state sales tax was scheduled to go down from 6.3 to 5.7%. The governor's plan would make that temporary sales tax permanent. You know, there are a lot of conservatives who are elected to cut taxes, and they may be asked to vote essentially to increase taxes, to increase that sales tax in order to decrease the income tax. The governor also wants to get rid of some major deductions that homeowners enjoy, like the mortgage interest, the real estate tax deductions. And these are also, you know, tough votes because a lot of people use those deductions. So the tax issues and the budget issues are still very much out there and undecided at this point.
Have you got any prediction what's going to happen?
I really don't have any crystal ball on this one. The Senate leaders seem to indicate they are signed on to extending the sales tax and getting rid of some of the deductions. The House side, the leadership there, seem to indicate their caucus is not thrilled about having to vote for an extension of the sales tax, and they want to cut the budget more. This business about the tax also works into major budget decisions, such as on school finance. The governor's plan would keep base state aid per pupil at the current level for a year and then bump it up a smidgen, about $14 per student in the subsequent year. That is not a big increase. On the other side of the ledger, you've got a lawsuit against the state and a lower court ruling that says the state needs to increase school funding by at least $440 million. That's a major budget issue that is really in flux at this point.
And all of a sudden we have this situation where the Supreme Court steps in and says we're going to stay the lower court order and we're going to get into mediation. Mediation usually means compromise of some kind.
Right.
Is that going to happen?
That's going to be a tough nut to crack because the sides are so far apart on this. The plaintiff school districts said, look, you guys passed the school funding plan, a three-year plan, and then all of a sudden you started cutting back on that plan. The state, of course, argues we went through this recession, we had to cut back. The plaintiffs come back and say, you cut back during a time you were also cutting taxes. The plaintiffs won before a three-judge panel said, look, the state of Kansas, you need to start pumping money back into this to the tune of $440 million and possibly more. The Supreme Court has stayed that decision and at the request of the governor has said, okay, let's try mediation. This is kind of unprecedented. This is a case that has already been tried and was pending an appeal, and the Supreme Court has granted the motion and ordered mediation on the issues in this case. And so we're going to see. The sides are very far apart, so I'm not sure what mediation will accomplish at this point. There are some who say that the Supreme Court is kind of hearing what the legislature is doing over there, and there are conservatives in the legislature who want to kind of rein in how much the Supreme Court, there's a proposed constitutional amendment that would say to the courts, you can't really order us to appropriate funding for schools. That measure has passed the Senate, and it is kind of pending in the House.
Then we have, of course, the question that if they do get that amendment through the legislature, that has to go to the voters, right?
Right.
And so would the one about the selection of Supreme Court justices.
Right.
What's your take on that issue? It seems to me that that lower court decision was maybe part of what, along with the previous Supreme Court decision on the schools, was leading the impetus to change the way that justices and appellate court judges were selected.
Right. Basically, the Kansas Supreme Court and series of decisions in 2005 and 2006 told the legislature that they weren't adequately funding schools. So the legislature passed a three-year funding plan. Later on, they reneged on that plan. But ever since that time, there have been conservatives in the legislature who thought that the court overstepped its authority. So there has been heartburn over this for years, and now the Senate has approved a constitutional amendment that would prevent the courts from ordering lawmakers to spend more on schools. But they've also approved a constitutional amendment to let the governor select Supreme and Appeals Court judges subject to Senate confirmation. It would be much more like the federal system. Currently, when there is a vacancy on the Supreme Court or the Court of Appeals, there's a nominating commission that does interviews and checks and forwards three names to the governor, and the governor picks one of those. There are some in the legislature who think that that is not representative enough because this nominating commission has a majority of attorneys on it, and so they think attorneys are too much in control of the process. This has led to liberal opinions from the bench, and so they want an appointment system more like what they have on the federal level. When you kind of look at the legislature from up high, you see tax decisions, budget decisions, school funding decisions, and now judicial stuff, all kind of interrelated.
You indicated that these constitutional amendments, or at least the one on the Supreme Court justices, was kind of hung up in the House. And I know up until the last election, the reputation of the Kansas legislature was that the Senate was the more moderate body and the House was the more conservative body. Has that changed following the election? Is it reversed?
The Senate kind of fell into conservative hands because of the primary in August. A lot of moderate senators were defeated by legislators who were backed by the Kansas Chamber of Commerce and backed by Americans for Prosperity and the governor. So the Senate is pretty much in the hands of conservatives. Meanwhile, the House, because of redistricting and it was a judicial plan to change all the districts, you have 50-plus new members in the House. Many of these are kind of Tea Party-type conservatives, but some are moderates. To pass a constitutional amendment, you need two-thirds vote, and in the 125-member House, that is 84 votes. Well, there's 33 Democrats, so, you know, to block a constitutional amendment, they really only need 8, 9, 10 votes from the Republican side, and it appears at this point that they have that. Now, you know, when the session starts to wind down and, you know, arms start to get twisted, that could all change, but at this point, I think the constitutional amendments are having a little trouble in the House.
Do you see further developments in either abortion legislation or legislation affecting unions?
Well, on abortion, the Senate has already passed a bill that would prohibit doctors from performing abortions based on sex selection. That is now in the House, and there's another pretty lengthy bill in the House that touches on a number of abortion issues, and that may gain some traction too. As far as unions go, the House passed a bill that would basically prevent teachers from being able to have automatically deducted from their pay funds that would go to the Political Action Committee of the Kansas National Education Association. It would also limit political funding for public employee unions. Now, that has been passed by the House. It's been sitting in the Senate, and there are a lot of questions about constitutional that bill is. And so, really, the Senate hasn't worked on it yet. And there are many bills that are kind of aimed at unions and the Teachers Association. And these are all going to be debated pretty thoroughly throughout the rest of the session.
I sure appreciate you giving us your perspective on things from being right there at the State House.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Scott Rothschild is the State House reporter for the Lawrence Journal-World. He spoke with KCUR's Steve Bell.
In several states across the country, farmers are trying to bring back hemp. That's right, that close relative of marijuana that's used in a seemingly endless number of products, textiles, lotion, paper, even car parts. But like marijuana, it's illegal to grow hemp in the United States. But that's not stopping farmers in Kentucky, who are working with lawmakers to try to establish hemp as an alternative crop for struggling small tobacco producers. Jacob McClellan has this report from Harvest Public Media.
Brian Furnish walks through an old black tobacco barn near Cynthiana, Kentucky. These creaky old barns with loose boards and high ceilings dot most small farms here in central Kentucky. The barn is empty now, except for the musky aroma of tobacco. Furnish and his brothers are eighth-generation tobacco farmers. Now, they're looking to diversify by adding a new crop, industrial hemp.
You know, I'm not some crazy person who's been brainwashed. I mean, I look at the realities of it, and I've looked at the potential of it. It's not a tobacco replacement, but it could be better than corn and soybeans for us.
Brian Furnish says he's lucky to get 100 bushels of corn per acre, and those acres are few and far between here, where much of the farmland is hilly and marginal.
I think hemp could be better than corn and soybeans here, and I know it would be a lot better than all these fields of fescue that we don't do anything with other than put up two rows of hay a year.
Hemp is native to Kentucky and flourished here through World War II. But along with marijuana, it was classified as a controlled substance. Production ceased by 1958. Kentucky Agriculture Commissioner James Comer is leading the charge to pass legislation that establishes a regulatory framework for cultivating hemp. If passed, it will require criminal background checks for hemp growers, a minimum 10-acre plot, and GPS coordinates of hemp fields. Comer says central and eastern Kentucky have never been able to replace tobacco, and hemp provides an alternative.
20 years ago, even 10 years ago, every farm in Kentucky had a tobacco base. The government regulated tobacco. The government gave you a quota as to how much tobacco you could grow. So every little farm everywhere had tobacco patches.
Now tobacco has been deregulated and farmers can grow as much as they like. Big farmers have pushed the small farms out, and most of those big farms are concentrated in western Kentucky's fertile farmland. Small part-time farmers in central and eastern Kentucky were left behind.
They've never been able to replace the income that came from tobacco. I think industrial hemp is something that you can grow in smaller quantities. You don't have to grow 1,000 acres to make a profit like you do with corn or soybeans.
Marijuana and hemp are different varieties of the same species. The main distinction is marijuana's high level of THC, the compound that produces the drug's high. Hemp has trace amounts. The similar appearance has drawn criticism from law enforcement. On a Kentucky educational television panel, State Police Commissioner Rodney Brewer argued law enforcement cannot easily distinguish between hemp and marijuana, especially during aerial surveillance.
The big issue that we have is what is to prevent an unscrupulous farmer, maybe with or without his knowledge, from someone going in and planting 10, 15, 20 marijuana plants in the center of this 1-acre, 10-acre tract.
Comer says marijuana growers want to keep their plants away from hemp because cross-pollination reduces THC levels. If Kentucky passes its hemp bill, farmers still need an exemption from the Federal Drug Enforcement Agency, and that agency doesn't hand out exemptions willy-nilly. While 8 other states have passed laws to legalize hemp, the DEA has only given an exemption once, for research in Hawaii back in the 90s. So why bother passing a law if farmers can't grow the crop? Comer believes a tried-and-tested regulatory framework will help Kentucky avoid the conundrum states with medical marijuana laws face, where they can't attract industry for fear the federal government may shut things down.
There is a lot of economic demand for this, and I believe that in a few years it'll be legal to grow all over the United States. But hopefully by then Kentucky's locked up the market and we have all the industrial manufacturing jobs here and our farmers are have a new option of a good crop to grow in Kentucky.
Comer has some powerful political allies, including Kentucky's Republican Senators Mitch McConnell and Rand Paul, who co-sponsored a bill in the U.S. Senate to exclude hemp from the Controlled Substances Act. Other supporters include Kentucky Congressman Thomas Massey and John Yarmuth, who filed similar legislation in the U.S. House. Three companies already want to offer farmers hemp contracts. At the state level, the bill sailed through the Senate. But in the House, the Agriculture Committee chairman blocked a vote on the bill in late February in a contentious showdown that riled hemp supporters. Kentucky's governor opposes the legislation for fears it will complicate marijuana eradication efforts. And Kentucky farmers may not find the pot of green gold they're hoping for. The potential market for hemp is relatively unknown, and the rest of the industrial world already produces it, led by China and Canada. So Kentucky farmers would have a lot of catching up to do just to get a piece of a relatively small pie. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Jacob McClelland.
You're listening to Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. If you spend any amount of time going to concerts or music shows in Kansas City, you've probably seen a tall, thin man with a shock of gray hair, usually standing by himself, often near the back of the club. He might say hi to passing friends, but this guy's a lot more tuned into the music than your typical concert goer. And he should be. He's working. For the past 16 years, Tim Finn has been the pop music editor for the Kansas City Star. This week, he's the subject of the latest installment in our occasional Odd Job series. When Tim Finn went to college at MU in the 1980s, he was, he admits, kind of a music snob. He was a devotee of 80s punk rock and early alternative rock like The Replacements and REM. But as he started writing about music, he wound up getting assigned to cover bands he'd never listened to on his own. He told Alex Smith that, eventually, an assignment to cover a heavy metal concert opened his eyes and changed the way he thought about music.
Probably the show, one of the more pivotal shows I ever saw. Metallica came to Sandstone, and this was back in the late 90s, probably 97 maybe 98. I'd heard them, you know, but I didn't devour them. I didn't listen to them. I knew some of their music, and I had friends who listened to them casually. So my impression of them was pretty naive and uninformed. They offered me an interview with, you know, James Hetfield, the guitar player, and I took it. Frankly, I was a little nervous about it as I prepared for it because I had no sound perception of him or who he was. And the music is aggressive and angry, and so I don't know what I was expecting. But did the interview, and he turned out to be one of the nicest guys I've ever interviewed, just a real down-to-earth, funny, witty, friendly guy. So that sort of changed things a little bit. And then I went to the show, and like I said, I've come around to like them now, A. And B, what I appreciated was, A, how they treated their fans, how they acted on stage, how humble they seemed, and how much they showed their appreciation for their fans, and likewise, the way the fans acted. Because I remember turning around, and there were 18,000 people there. Nobody was leaving their seats to go get beer. You know, there was just a lot of respect in the ferocity of the response. And I remember thinking, I don't think I've ever gone to a show to see a band I've really loved and witnessed this kind of response. And it was just pretty transforming. And yeah, it showed me they love their music just as much as I love mine. Nobody's, you know, there's no right or wrong answers. You can argue some intellectual points about what's artistically better or more influential. But I think when it comes to live music, you show up, you have a great time. And no matter who it is, if that's what happens, then mission accomplished, you know.
Uh-huh. That sounds like a big difference from a lot of the punk bands like in the 80s who wouldn't necessarily like show a lot of respect for their audience.
Right. because probably, you know, I saw The Replacements once and it was just, it was a mess. It was kind of beyond disappointing, you know, you felt disrespected. And I'd seen R.E.M. a couple times, and like I said, the difference between what I saw at that Metallica show and what I'd seen before, it woke me up. And I sort of killed my snooty hipster, I can't believe you like that stuff, or, you know, that stuff's beneath me. I just became a little more, I'm more about, you know, just have something you're passionate about, some kind of music, and, you know, it starts there.
So what are the styles or maybe genres that you have kind of struggled the most to learn to appreciate?
Hardcore rap, and it's not because I don't appreciate it, but there's a lot of skills. I started out listening to songwriters, and lyrics became important. So I think, you know, you want to feel like you're being spoken to, or someone's connecting with you and your life and your history or your lifestyle. I grew up in a really small town. I don't connect lyrically with a lot of hardcore rap. I can appreciate it. I've been to several shows. I sort of watch and appreciate all the energy. And I mean, lyrically, that stuff is, some of it's amazing. But I don't feel it, you know, viscerally. So that's one. Really, you know, the hair metal is cartoonish. It's amusing, but I never really connected with that. I guess, you know, I can appreciate just about anything. There's also this genre of bands who, how do I put this? It's they're pretty vanilla, and they're trying to be very R&B, Motown, soulful, and they're not. And I have a problem with that. It's pretty milquetoast stuff. There's usually a handsome guy singing, pretending he's Luther Vandross or Marvin Gaye or something, and it doesn't work for me, you know. Few guys can pull that off, you know, and I can name bands like Matchbox 20 and Maroon 5 and Train, or those are the ones where, nope, it's just not happening.
When you were first starting to write for The Star, what was the pop music writing like?
Well, it focused widely on, as I remember, national events, and we still do. But it seemed to be almost exclusively that because, you know, I mean, I would interview a lot of people coming to Kemper Arena or Sandstone, a lot of the big bands. Back then, I mean, you could have access. If David Bowie did an interview with the New York Times, maybe you could read it, but maybe he talked to Rolling Stone. But there wasn't, obviously now you can find information on people like him anywhere, all over the place, and a lot of it's redundant. So I think back then the imperative was more like, let's cover our local scene, the national events in our local scene, the big concerts, the people coming. If we can snag an interview with, you know, anybody, somebody in Aerosmith or somebody in Springsteen's band or whoever, there was a lot more of that. And that's probably the thing that has changed the most over the last 5, maybe even 10 years, is shifting our focus to the local scenes and the local bands.
Now, there are, you know, obviously lots of kinds of musical writing. There are people who, you know, want to try to promote bands or scenes, and then there's others who kind of work as critics. How do you see your role at The Star?
Well, that's changed a lot. You know, I think what I like doing most now, and this goes back to what I said before about the local scene, because it's so vibrant right now, and I like writing about the people in it, the musicians, the songwriters, the guys in the bands, because almost everyone is, it's a sacrifice of time and money and sometimes relationships. It's a lot of work. Everybody's usually working other jobs. It's a mission of love. It's, you know, most of them tell me I've stopped doing it, but I can't quit, you know, when I'm not doing it, just because it's become too inconvenient, or, you know, people get married, have kids, or, you know, things happen, bands break up. But it seems like everybody comes back because it's so innate to them. And it's all about loving what they're doing. And there are so many really talented musicians in this town. And I've just, over the last few years, just started to write about them. And that's what I like doing the most, informing readers about, you know, a show they could go to, maybe spend $7. It's at a small club. And you're going to enjoy this as much as any arena show if you put your mind to it. So there's that element to it. On the other side of that is, you know, we used to do a lot of like album reviews and CD reviews to try to get people to make them aware of stuff that's coming out. But the way music is released now, that whole concept has just been kind of shot because, you know, people ask me, well, what do you think of this record? Are you going to write about it? And I say, well, you can go listen to it. You can decide on your own. I mean, I can tell you what I think about it, but right now I don't think there's a better way to figure out whether you like a CD or a band, then it's right there for you, you know? It's like, why tell me to describe that plate of food? Why don't you just eat it and see if you like it?
So you've been going to shows, you know, very regularly for decades now. I wonder if you have like a best show or, you know, maybe a couple best shows that you've ever seen.
I do. Radiohead is at the top of the list, and I've seen them 3 times now. I saw them in St. Louis in 2003. It was the first time I'd seen them. I was set up to be kind of blown away, and I was. The show was really hyped to me, like, this is going to be like something you've never seen. I was a little skeptical I was going to like it that much, but I did. I liked it more than that. They came here in April, I think, or March. I guess it was March. But I'd seen them in St. Louis 2 nights before, and that show was as good as that other St. Louis show I saw. The one here was good, but a very different show. So Radiohead is one. Prince played at Kemper Arena, I think, in 1998, and I was in like the 5th row, and he is just one of the greatest live performers I've ever seen. There was a show, I saw David Byrne came to Memorial Hall, I think, and it was 2001. Not very many people showed up. The place holds like 3,300. There might have been 800 people there. They just let everybody on the floor, and he just lit the fuse and let it go. And I just remember, kind of because of those circumstances and what the set list he put out, that it was one of those shows where I buzzed about it for a couple of days. And it was not this big, epic, you know, sold-out arena show. It was kind of just a show that either got lost or just, you know, I was surprised at how small the crowd was, but it ended up that it didn't matter because he really took charge of the place, and it was a blast.
Well, do you have, like, a worst show that you have seen?
Oh, well, yeah, and it was because of actually, yes, no doubt, it was the show that, it was Matchbox 20 and Train together, so... But it was the Sunday after September 11th. They didn't cancel the show. They weren't playing baseball or football then, but this show went on for some reason. And it was awful. And people were acting like nothing was wrong. Or, you know, and their excuse was, hey, we need to kind of forget about things. And I went out there thinking that it wasn't going to happen or, you know, nobody would show up. But there were probably 12,000 people there. And it was like nothing had ever happened. And yeah, it was awful. I hated being there. I don't like those bands anyway, but that was definitely the first, you know, on the top of the list.
Mm-hmm. How often these days do you see shows?
It can be it's usually no more than 4 a week. That's a lot. 2 to 3 is average, you know. It depends on the schedule, you know. The live scene has its seasons, you know. Summer's busier. The outdoor venues are working. So there was a stretch recently, I think I did like 4 and 6 nights, and it's kind of grueling, but I'm out there watching people like music. It's not hard, but there's a, you know, it takes time, and they're late hours and early mornings. So 4 is plenty in a week.
Mm-hmm. And you wear earplugs?
I don't, but my hearing's fine. I make sure I'm as far enough away as I can be. You know, a lot of times, I always put a set list in the review, which requires that I hear some lyrics if I don't know a song. And with earplugs, I can't. And I can't pick up, you know, some of the... I like to hear the music, and the earplugs distract me, and I can't hear what I want to hear. So there are some... there was a show... I've stood outside the room sometimes because, like, at the Midland or the Uptown, because it's so crushingly loud, even in the back of the room. But that... I have to be outside the room. One was a Chemical Brothers show at the Uptown, and then Motorhead played at the Midland. And there were local musicians, guys in bands who play in loud rock bands, who were like running out of the room at that one because it was just punishing.
So how has live music in Kansas City changed since you started covering it?
Well, there are more venues on both ends. There's more theaters doing big shows. You know, we have the Sprint Center. We have the Midland and the Uptown. The Voodoo Lounge at Harris Casino is a big room. The Crossroads KC behind Grinders, that holds like 3,000 people in that place. So there are more rooms and venues doing shows. By far, there's a lot more. And then at the smaller level, there are more clubs doing shows. So any night, there is usually, I can look at the calendar and think, yeah, I would go to this tonight. And it's rare that there's not something going on. There are a lot more local bands now, and a lot more good local bands.
Mm-hmm. Now, have you seen trends in local music or concerts in the past few years that you really don't like?
Starting late, and I don't know if that's a trend or if it's always been that way. And I wrote about this a few months ago, how it would be nice if, you know, a lot of the smaller clubs will put the opener on at 10 or 10:30, which, and sometimes they have three bands, which means the headliner doesn't go on until after midnight. And there's this, there's a reason for it. And one of the reasons is that people think, well, nobody goes out before 9, or, you know, people don't start going out till 10 o'clock. You don't want the headliner coming on. The two people will miss the first two bands. There's probably something to that. However, you know, when Radiohead comes to town or Wilco comes to town, the show starts at 7:30 or 8, and people show up and fill the place. So people are accustomed to going to a show like it's a movie or whatever at 7:30, maybe skip the opener and watch the headliner at 8:45 or 9 o'clock and going home at 11:30. I wish there were more of that. I think it hurts attendance. The club owners want people in there, you know, buying food and drinks, and they don't want people emptying the place at 11:30. That's a dynamic, and I don't know if there's an answer, but I think off the bat, I would say I wish more shows started at a reasonable hour.
So what's the hardest part of your job?
I don't think any of it's hard. I think the part that I wish I could cover more, there's so much to write about and getting to it because there's so much more to do. The whole, you know, there's so much more to take care of, whether it's the blog or the social media, and there's just a lot more little work to do. And that takes away from doing bigger stories. I would like to do more big stories, more profiles, and then covering the shows, the live shows, because there used to be two people doing this. There hasn't been for a while, but it could definitely be a two-person job. That would be great. The freelancers probably add up to half a person, you know, maybe. So that helps. But I don't think any of it's hard because I like doing it, and I like meeting the people in the local scene, and I like writing about it. I like writing about the local scene more than just promoting another big-name band that's coming to the Sprint Center that doesn't really necessarily need the promotion. You just need to let people know they're going to be there.
You know? Well, so what's the best part of your job?
Being at a show where people are going crazy. It helps if I like the band. And I would say that Radiohead show in St. Louis, which I went to on my own, didn't write about it, and we were really close to the stage and just getting swept up in the enthusiasm and, you know, the transcendence of the show. And it's, you know, it can be spiritual. Definitely, it can be at the right moment, at the right time, the right band. That's the best part.
Tim Finn, thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Tim Finn is the pop music editor for the Kansas City Star. This interview first aired last September. If you can't listen to all of Casey Kearns today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives. And we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes. Last year, Susan caught up with Casey's guru of line dancing and the Kansas City Two-Step. That's Dee Barker. She's a software engineer by day and in the evening teaches dance classes at Southeast Community Center. Susan stopped by to check it out.
It's an unseasonably warm Thursday night in late March, and the parking lot is packed. The brightly lit Southeast Community Center is abuzz with activity. People are exercising, attending classes, and shooting hoops. But one class stands out. The music is bumping in Dee Barker's line dancing and step class. Dee Barker, a petite pecan brown woman with an afro, calls out the line dance moves. Women of all ages execute a complicated series of steps with gusto. The energy is high, and a crowd gathers outside of the open window to observe the action. Apparently, the class participants attend faithfully, although there are a few first-timers here tonight. During breaks, I ask the women, what has them hooked on line dancing? And what does the dance form mean in the African-American community?
Hello, I'm Yvette. A lot of our culture is based on dance. That's how we celebrate. That's how we praise. That's how we worship. That's how we almost do everything. I mean, some of us even dance while we're cleaning up the house. I mean, dance is just huge for the African-American culture.
It reminds me of just the respect that our ancestors have given to us back in the past. through dance and music and song, and to be able to get together without there being any type of competitions or anything, just get together and dance just for the respect of love and just coming together as one. It's a beautiful thing. And it's not even an African-American thing. It's like a culture thing, because you have Caucasians, you have blacks, you have men, you have women, you have kids. Everyone's doing it. And you're just having so much fun.
Hi, my name is Sonia.
So when you're out at clubs or at a wedding, what does line dancing do for you?
Well, a lot of times, I'm a single person. So usually, a lot of times I'm by myself. And line dance gives a good opportunity for a group event for everybody to get in and start having fun without having to worry about having a partner or anything. So, you know, it can be just self-motivating.
I'm Shakita.
And how long have you been coming to the class?
This is my first day.
Really? Mm-hmm. What made you come here?
I just like line dancing, and I'm too scared to do it in front of everybody, so I figured maybe I could learn here.
Ah, so once you've learned, where do you hope to use it?
I guess at the club.
At the club?
Yeah.
Okay, the name of this dance is Show Up. The name of the song is Coming Up. It came from, say, it's a St. Louis dance from STL Slideshow. Stephanie Crusoe is the choreographer.
Later, the class shifts into a second phase, the stepping portion. Men arrive, and the class swells to over 20 people. Participants find a partner and begin doing a rhythmic and sensual couples dance with fancy footwork, swings, and turns. I ask participants how they would describe stepping and why they love it so much.
Oh, stepping is a motion and the rhythm of two people in synchronization. That's what stepping is.
Shannon Thompson, just kind of being in sync with that young lady while the music is going, and y'all just got a vibe going, looking good, you know.
I'm Grady Bell. It's poetry in motion with bodies, you know what I'm saying?
My name is Philip Eugene Gibbs. How would I describe 2-7? It's best dance in the world.
Standing up, seven count, right start. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 4.
Dee has been dubbed Kansas City's queen of line dancing and step instruction. She teaches a number of classes around town and participates in competitions in other states with her troupe D Unit, as well as the KC Two-Step and Sliders. I wondered, how did Dee Barker become so passionate about line dancing and stepping? And what's happening on Kansas City's line dancing scene? How have these dance forms developed a uniquely Kansas City style? I talked to Dee about these questions and more.
I started dancing, I was the baby of 5 girls. And by the time my mom was pregnant, the 5th time, my dad just knew I was going to be a boy. I wasn't. So he took me under his wing and made me do fishing and sports and enrolled me in dancing and all that. And when he came home from his night outings, he would wake me up to dance for his friends. So I just learned, and they would pay me to dance. They would give me little dollars to dance, and then they call me. I wouldn't take change. You know, you give kids change for dancing. I wouldn't take change, because they start calling me Buck Benny. And then they start singing the song, Buck Benny, don't take no pennies.
Have you ever met anybody you couldn't teach to line dance?
Well, there's a lot of people that, even though they're black, African-American, they don't have rhythm, you know, so that's a myth. So some people I look at, are you one of us? So I just work with them. I have to find their niche. What works, some people are count people. Some people are left, right, left people. And sometimes I'll just tell them, I give them an exercise, like bob your head in the car. Just bob your head in the car, because rhythm is of the utmost importance in executing the steps. You got to have that rhythm, that timing with your head bobbing and your finger snapping. So
what are the other elements that people need to learn in order to do line dancing well?
Besides the rhythm, how to feel the song, how to, you know, I create dances, I'm a choreographer, and in order for me to do that, it has to be an R&B funk beat, and it has to move me, you know, it has to inspire me. So, you know, if they just, you know, hear some music that they like, and it's half the battle, you know, as far as that you like, and you can hone into the beat and the rhythm of it, and you've got that step and that groove and that vibe, and then, you know, just learn the steps, and it's all uphill from there.
So you try to get people to get beyond the electric slide, the Cupid shuffle, the wobble.
So offended when people do the Cupid shuffle and the wobble. I mean, I like those dances and all that, but we need to put those in our database and add more to them.
Right.
Yeah.
You feeling good? Let me say all right, all right. And what up? All right. Pooh Bear, I'm feeling good, so I'm saying myself. All right, all right.
Dee Barker teaches line dancing and the Kansas City Two-Step at the Southeast Community Center. After the break, a debut album from the violin and cello duo, The Wires. This is Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. Ever pass something that catches your eye when you're walking or driving around? Something that makes you turn your head and wonder? Casey Currents explores these curiosities in a series we call What Is That? Here's one that a listener asked us to find out about. Something he saw driving down K7 Highway near Olathe. KCUR's Kayla Regan looked into it.
From K7 south, it really doesn't look like much. Just four poles and some kind of stone. But if you take Hedges Avenue, the road that runs next to the exit ramp, you'll come across a parking area. It seems to be designated for the mysterious highway monument. Once you get out of the car, it's easy to see that this stone is actually a gravestone. The poles that surround it are wrought iron and adorned with decorative leaves. To the right of the stone are planted flowers that have died in the winter. The gravestone is about 2 feet tall and shows a hand pointing to the word rest. The stone reads, Asa C., son of F.M. and E.F. Smith, born November 15, 1856, died August 30, 1857. That would have made Asa 8 months old when he died.
This is only about the second time. I've been past it a lot of times, but to stop here, this is the second time.
It's Bertha Cameron that shows me the grave. She's one of the founders of the Monticello Historical Society and a lifelong Johnson County resident.
I think through the years, it's always been a curiosity, and I think probably for a lot of people, it's a curiosity of who was that.
The grave is technically located in Lenexa, about halfway between Olathe and the old Monticello area. And from her research, it becomes evident that the story of Asa Smith and his family is very much a story about what was going on in Kansas at that time.
There were people, immigrants, coming from the east, well, from all different directions, really, some of them from the north and some from the south, different directions, to settle this area. As you know from Kansas history, that Kansas Territory was founded in 1854, and that there was this slavery issue.
Cameron's referring to Bloody Kansas, when people from the north and south were rushing here to determine its future as either a free state or slave state. In 1865, Fountain and Emily Smith, along with their newborn son Asa, moved from Alabama to Johnson County. Even though the Smiths were from the South, Cameron says that doesn't mean they were coming here to push for slavery.
They had Southern sympathies, probably. We know that there were others, there were people who came here for that purpose, to make Kansas a slave state, if they came from the South. That doesn't mean they had to. I mean, it doesn't mean that they definitely did, because some of them from the South, you know, didn't care or whatever. They just were looking for the land.
The government previously promised the Johnson County area to the Shawnee tribe. But in 1854, the government decided to let others in to claim the land. Just a few years later, people were rushing here to get a piece of it. Cameron says Johnson County was seen as kind of a paradise, with timber, wild fruits, and prairie hay.
The families of the missionaries had written back home and said that this was a land of milk and honey, that there was everything here that anybody could desire.
Of course, less than a year after they settled, Asa died. Cameron says there's no way to know how, but it was likely pneumonia or another illness. The Smiths buried their only child on the property, but likely without any frills or excess ceremony.
And I think that they understood that that was a hard life, that it was hard times, and there probably had been deaths similar to that in their family before.
After Asa's death, Fountain and his wife Emily went on to have more children. In 1863, Fountain, the man with Southern sympathies, seemed to have a change of heart. He signed up for the Kansas Militia, which was a Union state by that time.
Right. Isn't that interesting? And that happened so many times. It's just like the men who came to found the town of Monticello. They were all pro-slavery, but then they all ended up in the Union Army as well. I think they could see what was happening eventually.
By 1865, the 160 acres Fountain originally purchased grew to 400. He sold all of it that year and moved to Leavenworth County, leaving behind his son Asa's grave. So now, more than 150 years after Asa's death, why do we still care about his grave? Cameron says there are tons of unmarked graves in Johnson County from children who died on the trail west. Why is this one important enough to protect and even restore? It helped that there was a name on the grave, but Cameron says it's also something more than that.
And just think that that was some pioneer, some early settler, and it would be a symbol, maybe, of all of those who came early on.
The gravestone that now sits by the highway isn't the original. It was replaced by Boy Scouts. And a sign next to the grave reads that the site is maintained by Atmos Energy. The four poles around the grave protect it from lawnmowers. So, it seems that for the time being at least, this one child's story is being remembered. Kayla Regan, KCUR News.
This story is a part of Casey Current's What Is That series. It first aired in January of 2012. To suggest another curiosity you'd like us to explore, email us at kccurrents@kcur.org.
All of the music in between segments in today's show came from a debut album by the Kansas City strings duo The Wires. Cellist Sasha Groshong and violinist Laurel Morgan Parks were both classically trained at UMKC's Conservatory of Music and Dance, but they're creating a sound they call alternative strings, a blend between classical and world folk music. Groshong and Parks told Central Standard 2 years ago that they'd played together many times before they tried writing a song together.
Sasha said, "I have this idea, and I'm going to send it to you, I'm going to email it to you, and you listen to it and see if you can come up with anything." So she had kind of a percussive riff, and I came up with a melody, and it went from there.
Yeah, in New York, I had listened to a lot of really innovative string techniques. There's a lot of cellists there doing all these hitting techniques and pizzicato techniques on their instruments, and I kind of listened to that and fooled around with it on my own, and then came up with something and presented it to Laurel, and it took off from there.
That's what their songwriting process is often like, and it's made easier by the fact that they're now neighbors in Hyde Park.
Usually one of us will come up with some sort of riff or just a melody or something, and we'll present it to the other one, and we'll go back and forth, and a lot of times it's kind of like an improv session. We'll kind of fool with something until it comes out right, and a lot of times we'll take it home and kind of stew with it on our own first, mm-hmm. and then bring it back together and kind of mash it together until it's right.
Kansas City's geography served as the inspiration for their song, Zero is the River.
Zero is the street, I guess you could say.
First street in Kansas City, that's where the numbers start?
Yeah, from North Kansas City and then going to South Kansas City, the numbers build from the Missouri River. And so we were thinking of this song as kind of a cold, wintry Siberian song, and we thought of the ice. Sometimes when it's really snowy here, the ice drifting by in the Missouri River.
There's like ice chunks. So it was like a Kansas City way of being in Siberia and Kansas City at the same time.
That was Laurel Morgan Parks and Sasha Groshong talking about their album in progress 2 years ago on Central Standard. That album was released this weekend. It's called The Wires Alternative Strings. We'll go out with one more song, Ruska Roma. We're listening to the song Ruska Roma from the Kansas City band The Wires' self-titled debut album. You can hear them next at Cowtown Ballroom on April 14th.
Well, we certainly thank you for tuning in to KC Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the KC Currents page at kcur.org.
You can also hear individual stories there or sign up for our podcast. Find us on iTunes. Contact us at kccurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at kccurrents.
KC Currents is produced by Sylvia with associate producer Alex Smith. Our interns are Zach Lewandowski and Monica Sandretsky. Theme music is by Approach, and I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.